2nd Avenue and the taxis are shiny yellow in the sun. A black man wearing Walkman earphones is walking past Choo Choo Mamas. Eddie can see him. Eddie knows the black man is listening to Elton John singing, "What else? Someone saved my life tonight." The sidewalk is crowded. It's late afternoon and people are going home after another day in the steel arroyos of Kala, New York, where they grow money instead of rice. Can you say prime rate? Women looking amiably weird in expensive business suits and sneakers. Their high heels are in their gunna because the workday is done, and they're going home. Everyone seems to be smiling because the light is so bright and the air is so warm. It's summer in the city, and somewhere there's the sound of a jackhammer, like on that old Lovin' Spoonful song. Before him is a door into the summer of 77. The cabbies are getting a buck and a quarter on the drop and 30 cents every fifth of a mile thereafter. It was less before, and it'll be more after, but this is now, the dancing point of now. The space shuttle with the teacher on board hasn't blown up. John Lennon is still alive, although he won't be much longer if he doesn't stop messing with that wicked heroine, that China White. As for Eddie Dean, Edward Cantor Dean, he knows nothing about heroin. A few cigarettes are his only vice, other than trying to jack off, at which he will not be successful for almost another year. He's 13. It's 1977, and he has exactly 4 hairs on his chest. He counts them religiously each morning, hoping for big number 5. It's the summer after the summer of the tall ships. It's a late afternoon in the month of June, and he can hear a happy tune. The tune is coming from the speakers over the doorway of the Tower of Power record shop. It's Mungo Jerry singing "In the Summertime," and suddenly it was all real to him. Or as real as he thought he needed it to be. Eddie raised his left hand and popped up his thumb. "Let's go." Behind him, Roland had sat down and eased the box out of the pink bag. And when Eddie gave him the thumbs up, the gunslinger opened the box. Eddie's ears were immediately assaulted by a sweetly dissonant jangle of chimes. His eyes began to water. In front of him, the freestanding door clicked open, and the cave was suddenly illuminated by strong sunlight. There was the sound of beeping horns and the rat-a-tat-tat of a jackhammer. Not so long ago, he had wanted a door like this so badly that he'd almost killed Roland to get it. And now that he had it, he was scared to death. The toad-ash chimes felt as if they were tearing his head apart. If he listened to that for long, he'd go insane. "Go if you're going," he thought. He stepped forward, through his gushing eyes, seeing 3 hands reach out and grasp 4 doorknobs. He pulled the door toward him, and golden late-day sunlight dazzled his eyes. He could smell gasoline and hot city air and someone's aftershave. Hardly able to see anything, Eddie stepped through the unfound door and into the summer of a world from which he was now fan-gone, the exiled one. 4. It was 2nd Avenue, all right. Here was the Blimpies. And from behind him came the cheery sound of that Mungo Jerry song with the Caribbean beat. People moved around him in a flood, uptown, downtown, all around the town. They paid no attention to Eddie, partly because most of them were only concentrating on getting out of town at the end of another day, mostly because in New York, not noticing other people was a way of life. Eddie shrugged his right shoulder, settling the strap of Roland's swag bag there more firmly, then looked behind him. The door back to Kala Bryn Sturgis was there. He could see Roland sitting at the mouth of the cave with the box open on his lap. "Those fucking chimes must be driving him crazy," Eddie thought. And then, as he watched, he saw the gunslinger remove a couple of bullets from his gun belt and stick them in his ears. Eddie grinned. "Good move, man." At least it had helped to block out the warble of the thinny back on I-70. Whether it worked now or whether it didn't, Roland was on his own. Eddie had things to do. He turned slowly on his little spot of the sidewalk, then looked over his shoulder again to verify the door had turned with him. It had. If it was like the other ones, it would now follow him everywhere he went. Even if it didn't, Eddie didn't foresee a problem. He wasn't planning on going far. He noticed something else as well. That sense of darkness lurking behind everything was gone. Because he was really here, he supposed, and not just Todash. If there were vagrant dead lurking in the vicinity, he wouldn't be able to see them. Once more, shrugging the swag bag strapped further up on his shoulder, Eddie set off for the Manhattan restaurant of the mind. 5. People moved aside for him as he walked, but that wasn't quite enough to prove he was really here. People did that when you were Todash, too. At last, Eddie provoked an actual collision with a young guy toting not one briefcase, but two, a big coffin hunter of the business world, if Eddie had ever seen one. "Hey, watch where you're going," Mr. Businessman squawked when their shoulders collided. "Sorry, man, sorry," Eddie said. He was here, all right. "Say, could you tell me what they..." But Mr. Businessman was already gone, chasing the coronary he'd probably catch up to around the age of 45 or 50, from the look of him. Eddie remembered the punchline of an old New York joke. "Pardon me, sir, can you tell me how to get to City Hall, or should I just go fuck myself?" He burst out laughing, couldn't help it. Once he had himself back under control, he got moving again. On the corner of 2nd and 54th, he saw a man looking into a shop window at a display of shoes and boots. This guy was also wearing a suit, but looked considerably more relaxed than the one Eddie had bumped into. Also, he was carrying only a single briefcase, which Eddie took to be a good omen. "Cry your pardon," Eddie said, "but could you tell me what day it is?" "Thursday," the window shopper said, "the 23rd of June." "1977? The window shopper gave Eddie a little half-smile, both quizzical and cynical, plus a raised eyebrow. "1977, that's correct. Won't be 1978 for, gee, another 6 months. Think of that." Eddie nodded. "Thank you, Si." "Thank you what?" "Nothing," Eddie said, and hurried on. Only 3 weeks to July 15th, give or take, he thought. That's cutting it too goddamn close for comfort. Yes, but if he could persuade Calvin Tower to sell him the lot today, the whole question of time would be moot. Once, a long time ago, Eddie's brother had boasted to some of his friends that his little bro could talk the devil into setting himself on fire, if he really set his mind to it. Eddie hoped he still had some of that persuasiveness. Do a little deal with Calvin Tower, invest in some real estate, then maybe take a half-hour time out and actually enjoy that New York groove a little bit. Celebrate. Maybe get a chocolate egg cream, or... The run of his thoughts broke off, and he stopped so suddenly that someone bumped into him and then swore. Eddie barely felt the bump or heard the curse. The dark gray Lincoln Town Car was parked up there again. Not in front of the fire hydrant this time, but a couple of doors down. Balazar's Town Car. Eddie started walking again. He was suddenly glad Roland had talked him into taking one of his revolvers, and that the gun was fully loaded. Six. The chalkboard was back in the window. Today's special was a New England boiled dinner consisting of Nathaniel Hawthorne, Henry David Thoreau, and Robert Frost. For dessert, your choice of Mary McCarthy or Grace Metalius. But the sign hanging in the door read, "Sorry, we're closed." According to the digital bank clock up the street from Tower of Power Records, it was 3:14 p.m. Who shut up shop at 3:15 on a weekday afternoon? Someone with a special customer, Eddie reckoned. That was who. He cupped his hands to the sides of his face and looked into the Manhattan restaurant of the mind. He saw the small round display table with the children's books on it. To the right was the counter that looked as if it might have been filched from a turn-of-the-century soda fountain, only today no one was sitting there. Not even Aaron Deepno. The cash register was likewise unattended, although Eddie could read the words on the orange tab sticking up in its window. No sale. Place was empty. Calvin Tower had been called away. Maybe there'd been a family emergency. He's got an emergency, all right. The gunslinger's cold voice spoke up in Eddie's head. It came in that gray auto carriage, and look again at the counter, Eddie. Only this time, why don't you actually use your eyes, instead of just letting the light pour through them? Sometimes he thought in the voices of other people. He guessed lots of people did that. It was a way of changing perspective a little, seeing stuff from another angle. But this didn't feel like that kind of pretending. This felt like old Long Tall and Ugly actually talking to him inside his head. Eddie looked at the counter again. This time he saw the strew of plastic chessmen on the marble and the overturned coffee cup. This time he saw the spectacles lying on the floor between two of the stools, one of the lenses cracked. He felt the first pulse of anger deep in the middle of his head. It was dull, but if past experience was any indicator, the pulses were apt to come faster and harder, growing sharper as they did. Eventually, they would blot out conscious thought, and God help anyone who wandered within range of Roland's gun when that happened. He had once asked Roland if this happened to him, and Roland had replied, "It happens to all of us." When Eddie had shaken his head and responded that he wasn't like Roland, not him, not Suze, not Jake, the gunslinger had said nothing. Tower and his special customers were out back, he thought, in that combination storeroom and office. And this time talking probably wasn't what they had in mind. Eddie had an idea this was a little refresher course, Balazar's gentleman reminding Mr. Tower that the 15th of July was coming, reminding Mr. Tower of what the most prudent decision would be once it came. When the word gentleman crossed Eddie's mind, it brought another pulse of anger with it. That was quite a word for guys who'd break a fat and harmless bookstore owner's glasses, then take him out back and terrorize him. Gentleman. Fuck Kamala. He tried the bookshop door. It was locked, but the lock wasn't such of a much. The door rattled in its jam like a loose tooth. Standing there in the recessed doorway, looking, he hoped, like a fellow who was especially interested in some book he'd glimpsed inside, Eddie began to increase his pressure on the lock, first using just his hand on the knob, then leaning his shoulder against the door in a way he hoped would look casual. Chances are 94 in 100 that no one's looking at you anyway. This is New York, right? Can you tell me how to get to City Hall, or should I just go fuck myself? He pushed harder. He was still a good way from exerting maximum pressure when there was a snap and the door swung inward. Eddie entered without hesitation, as if he had every right in the world to be there, then closed the door again. It wouldn't latch. He took a copy of How the Grinch Stole Christmas off the children's table, ripped out the last page, never liked the way this one ended anyway, he thought, folded it 3 times and stuck it into the crack between the door and the jamb. Good enough to keep it closed. Then he looked around. The place was empty. And now, with the sun behind the skyscrapers of the west side, shadowy. No sound. Yes, there was. A muffled cry from the back of the shop. Caution, gentlemen at work, Eddie thought, and felt another pulse of anger. This one was sharper. He yanked the tie on Roland's swag bag, then walked toward the door at the back, the one marked employees only. Before he got there, he had to skirt an untidy heap of paperbacks and an overturned display rack, the old-fashioned drugstore kind that turned around and around. Calvin Tower had grabbed at it as Balazar's gents hustled him toward the storage area. Eddie hadn't seen it happen. Didn't need to. The door at the back wasn't locked. Eddie took Roland's revolver out of the swag bag and set the bag itself aside so it wouldn't get in his way at a crucial moment. He eased the storage room door open inch by inch, reminding himself of where Tower's desk was. If they saw him, he'd charge, screaming at the top of his lungs. According to Roland, you always screamed at the top of your lungs when and if you were discovered. You might startle your enemy for a second or two, and sometimes a second or two made all the difference in the world. This time, there was no need for screaming or for charging. The men he was looking for were in the office area, their shadows once more climbing high and grotesque on the wall behind them. Tower was sitting in his office chair, but the chair was no longer behind the desk. It had been pushed into the space between two of the 3 filing cabinets. Without his glasses, his pleasant face looked naked. His 2 visitors were facing him, which meant their backs were to Eddie. Tower could have seen him, but Tower was looking up at Jack Andolini and George Biondi, concentrating on them alone. At the sight of the man's naked terror, another of those pulses went through Eddie's head. There was the tang of gasoline in the air, a smell which Eddie guessed would frighten even the most stout-hearted shop owner, especially one presiding over an empire of paper. Beside the taller of the two men, Andolini, was a glass-fronted bookcase about 5 feet high. The door was swung open. Inside were 4 or 5 shelves of books, all the volumes wrapped in what looked like clear plastic dust covers. Andolini was holding up one of them in a way that made him look absurdly like a TV pitchman. The shorter man, Biondi, was holding up a glass jar full of amber liquid in much the same way. Not much question about what it was.
"Please, Mr. Andolini," Tower said. He spoke in a humble, shaken voice. "Please, that's a very valuable book."
"Of course it is," Andolini said. "All the ones in the case are valuable. I understand you've got a signed copy of Ulysses that's worth $26,000.
"What's that about, Jack?"
George Biondi asked. He sounded awed.
"What kind of books worth 26 large?
"I don't know," Andolini said. "Why don't you tell us, Mr. Tower, or can I call you Cal?"
"My Ulysses is in a safe deposit box," Tower said. "It's not for sale."
"But these are," Andolini said, "aren't they? And I see the number 7,500 on a flyleaf of this one in pencil. No 26 grand, but still the price of a new car. So here's what I'm going to do, Cal. Are you listening?"
Eddie was moving closer, and although he strove to be quiet, he made no effort whatever to conceal himself. And still, none of them saw him. Had he been this stupid when he'd been of this world? This vulnerable to what was not even an ambush, properly speaking? He supposed he had been, and knew it was no wonder Roland had at first held him in contempt.
I'm listening."
"You've got something Mr. Balazar wants as badly as you want your copy of Ulysses. And although these books in the glass cabinet are technically for sale, I bet you sell damned few of them because you just can't bear to part with them, the way you can't bear to part with that vacant lot. So, here's what's going to happen. George is going to pour gasoline over this book with 7,500 on it, and I'm going to light it on fire. Then I'm going to take another book out of your little case of treasures, and I'm going to ask you for a verbal commitment to sell that lot to the Sombra Corporation at high noon on July 15th. Got that?" If you give me that verbal commitment, this meeting will come to an end. If you don't give me that verbal commitment, I'm going to burn the second book, then a third, then a fourth. After 4, sir, I believe my associate here is apt to lose patience."
"You're fucking A," George Biondi said.
Eddie was now almost close enough to reach out and touch Big Nose, and still they didn't see him.
"At that point, I think we'll just pour gasoline inside your little glass cabinet and set all your valuable books on..."
Movement at last snagged Jack Andolini's eye. He looked beyond his partner's left shoulder and saw a young man with hazel eyes looking out of a deeply tanned face. The man was holding what looked like the world's oldest, biggest prop revolver. Had to be a prop.
"Who the fucker?" Jack began. Before he could get any further, Eddie Dean's face lit up with happiness and good cheer, a look that vaulted him way past handsome and into the land of beauty. "George!" he cried. It was the tone of one greeting his oldest, fondest friend after a long absence. "George Biondi, man, you still got the biggest beak on this side of the Hudson. Good to see you, man."
There's a certain hardwiring in the human animal that makes us respond to strangers who call us by name. When the summoning call is affectionate, we seem almost compelled to respond in kind. In spite of the situation they were in back here, George Big Nose Biondi turned with the beginning of a grin toward the voice that had hailed him with such cheerful familiarity. That grin was, in fact, still blooming when Eddie struck him savagely with the butt of Roland's gun. Andolini's eyes were sharp, but he saw little more than a blur as the butt came down 3 times, the first blow between Biondi's eyes, the second above his right eye, the third into the hollow of his right temple. The first 2 blows provoked hollow, thudding sounds. The last one yielded a soft, sickening smack.
Biondi went down like a sack of mail, eyes rolling up to show the whites, lips puckering in a restless way that made him look like a baby who wanted a nurse. The jar tumbled out of his relaxing hand, hit the cement floor, shattered. The smell of gasoline was suddenly much stronger, rich and cloying. Eddie gave Biondi's partner no time to react. While Big Nose was still twitching on the floor in the spilled gas and broken glass, Eddie was on Andolini, forcing him backward. 7. For Calvin Tower, who had begun life as Calvin Torin, there was no immediate sense of relief, no thank God I'm saved feeling. His first thought was, they're bad. This new one is worse. In the dim light of the storage room, the newcomer seemed to merge with his own leaping shadow and become an apparition 10 feet tall. One with burning eyeballs starting from their sockets and a mouth pulled down to reveal jaws lined with glaring white teeth that almost looked like fangs. In one hand was a pistol that appeared to be the size of a blunderbuss, the kind of weapon referred to in 17th-century tales of adventure as a machine. He grabbed Andolini by the top of his shirt and the lapel of his sport coat and threw him against the wall. The hoodlum's hip struck the glass case and it toppled over. Tower gave a cry of dismay, to which neither of the two men paid the slightest attention. Balazar's man tried to wriggle away to his left. The new one, the snarling man with his black hair tied back behind him, let him get going, then tripped him and went down on top of him, one knee on the hoodlum's chest. He shoved the muzzle of the blunderbuss, the machine, into the soft shelf under the hoodlum's chin. The hoodlum twisted his head, trying to get rid of it. The new one only dug it in deeper. In a choked voice that made him sound like a cartoon duck, Balazar's torpedo said, "Don't make me laugh, Slick. That ain't no real gun." The new one, the one who had seemed to merge with his own shadow and become as tall as a giant, pulled his machine out from under the hoodlum's chin, cocked it with his thumb, and pointed it deep into the storage area. Tower opened his mouth to say something, God knew what, but before he could utter a word, there was a deafening crash, the sound of a mortar shell going off 5 feet from some hapless GI's foxhole. Bright yellow flame shot from the machine's muzzle. A moment later, the barrel was back under the hoodlum's chin. "What do you think now, Jack?" The new one panted. "Still think it's a fake? Tell you what I think. The next time I pull this trigger, your brains are going all the way to Hoboken." 8. Eddie saw fear in Jack Andolini's eyes, but no panic. This didn't surprise him. It had been Jack Andolini who'd collared him after the cocaine mule delivery from Nassau had gone wrong. This version of him was younger, 10 years younger, but no prettier. Andolini, once dubbed Old Double Ugly by the great sage and eminent junkie Henry Dean, had a bulging caveman's forehead and a jutting alley-oop jaw to match. His hands were so huge, they looked like caricatures. Hair sprouted from the knuckles. He looked like Old Double Stupid as well as Old Double Ugly, but he was far from dumb. Dummies didn't work their way up to become the second in command to guys like Enrico Balazar. And while Jack might not be that yet in this win, he would be by 1986 when Eddie would come flying back into JFK with about $200,000 worth of Bolivian marching powder under his shirt. In that world, that where and when, Andolini had become Il Roche's field marshal. In this one, Eddie thought there was a very good chance he was going to take early retirement. From everything. Unless, that was, he played it perfectly. Eddie shoved the barrel of the pistol deeper under Andolini's chin. The smell of gas and gunpowder was strong in the air, for the time being overwhelming the smell of books. Somewhere in the shadows there was an angry hiss from Sergio, the bookstore cat. Sergio apparently didn't approve of loud noises in his domain. Andolini winced and twisted his head to the left.
"Don't, man! That thing's hot."
"Not as hot as where you'll be 5 minutes from now," Eddie said, "unless you listen to me, Jack. Your chances of getting out of this are slim, but not quite none. Will you listen?"
"I don't know you. How do you know us?"
Eddie took the gun out from beneath Old Double Ugly's chin and saw a red circle where the barrel of Roland's revolver had pressed. "Suppose I told you that it's your car to meet me again 10 years from now and to be eaten by lobstrosities. That they'll start with the feet inside your Gucci loafers and work their way up." Andolini wouldn't believe him, of course. any more than he'd believed Roland's big old revolver would work until Eddie had demonstrated the truth. And along this track of possibility, on this level of the tower, Andolini might not be eaten by Lovestrosities. Because this world was different from all the others. This was level 19 of the Dark Tower. Eddie felt it. Later he would ruminate on it, but not now. Now, the very act of thinking was difficult. What he wanted right now was to kill both of these men, then head over to Brooklyn and tune up on the rest of Balazar's tet. Eddie tapped the barrel of the revolver against one of Andolini's jutting cheekbones. He had to restrain himself from really going to work on that ugly mug, and Andolini saw it. He blinked and wet his lips. Eddie's knee was still on his chest. Eddie could feel it going up and down like a bellows.
"You didn't answer my question," Eddie said. "What you did instead was ask a question of your own. The next time you do that, Jack, I'm going to use the barrel of this gun to break your face. Then I'll shoot out one of your kneecaps, turn you into a jackhopper for the rest of your life. I can shoot off a good many parts of you and still leave you able to talk. And don't play dumb with me. You're not dumb, except maybe in your choice of employer, and I know it. So let me ask you again, will you listen to me? What choice do I have?"
Moving with that same blurry, spooky speed, Eddie swept Roland's gun across Andolini's face. There was a sharp crack as his cheekbone snapped. Blood began to flow from his right nostril, which to Eddie looked about the size of the Queen's Midtown Tunnel. Andolini cried out in pain, Tower in shock. Eddie socked the muzzle of the pistol back into the soft place under Andolini's chin. Without looking away from him, Eddie said,
"Keep an eye on the other one, Mr. Tower. If he starts to stir, you let me know."
"Who are you?"
Tower almost bleated.
"A friend, the only one you've got who can save your bacon. Now watch him and let me work."
"Oh, all right."
Eddie Dean turned his full attention back to Andolini.
"I laid George out because George is stupid. Even if he could carry the message I need carried, he wouldn't believe it. And how can a man convince others of what he doesn't believe himself?"
"Got a point there," Andolini said.
He was looking up at Eddie with a kind of horrified fascination. Perhaps finally seeing this stranger with the gun for what he really was. For what Roland had known he was from the very beginning, even when Eddie Dean had been nothing but a wet-nosed junkie, shivering his way through heroin withdrawal. Jack Andolini was seeing a gunslinger.
"You bet I do," Eddie said, "and here's the message I want you to carry. Towers off limits."
Jack was shaking his head.
"You don't understand. Tower has something somebody wants. My boss agreed to get it. He promised. And my boss always keeps his promises, I know," Eddie said. "Only this time, he won't be able to, and that's not going to be his fault, because Mr. Tower has decided not to sell his vacant lot up the street to the Sombra Corporation. He's going to sell it to the... Tet Corporation instead. Got that?"
"Mister, I don't know you, but I know my boss. He won't stop."
"He will, because Tower won't have anything to sell. The lot will no longer be his. And now, listen even more closely, Jack. Listen, Kami, not Kamai."
Wisely, not foolishly. Eddie leaned down. Jack stared up at him, fascinated by the bulging eyes, hazel irises, bloodshot whites, and the savagely grinning mouth, which was now the distance of a kiss from his own.
"Mr. Calvin Tower has come under the protection of people more powerful and more ruthless than you could ever imagine, Jack. People who make Il Roche look like a hippie flower child at Woodstock. You have to convince him that he has nothing to gain by continuing to harass Calvin Tower and everything to lose."
"I can't.
As for you, know that the mark of Gilead is on this man. If you ever touch him again, if you ever even step foot in this shop again, I'll come to Brooklyn and kill your wife and children. Then I'll find your mother and father, and I'll kill them. Then I'll kill your mother's sisters and your father's brothers. Then I'll kill your grandparents if they're still alive. You I'll save for last. Do you believe me?"
Jack Andolini went on staring into the face above him, the bloodshot eyes, the grinning, snarling mouth, but now with mounting horror. The fact was, he did believe.
And whoever he was, he knew a great deal about Balazar and about this current deal. About the current deal, he might know more than Andolini knew himself.
"There's more of us," Eddie said, "and we're all about the same thing, protecting."
He almost said protecting the rose.
"Protecting Calvin Tower. We'll be watching this place. We'll be watching Tower. We'll be watching Tower's friends, guys like Deepino."
Eddie saw Andolini's eyes flicker with surprise at that and was satisfied.
"Anybody who comes here and even raises his voice to Tower, we'll kill their whole families and them last. That goes for George, for Cimidretto, Trix Postino, for your brother Claudio, too."
Andolini's eyes widened at each name, then winced momentarily shut at the name of his brother. Eddie thought that maybe he'd made his point. Whether or not Andolini could convince Balazar was another question, but in a way it doesn't even matter, he thought coldly. "Once Towers sold us the lot, it doesn't really matter what they do to him, does it?"
"How do you know so much?"
Andolini asked.
"That doesn't matter. Just pass on the message. Tell Balazar to tell his friends at Sambra that the lot is no longer for sale. Not to them, it isn't. And tell him that Tower is now under the protection of folk from Gilead who carry hard calibers." "Hard? I mean folk more dangerous than any Balazar has ever dealt with before," Eddie said,
"including the people from the Sambra Corporation. Tell him that if he persists, there'll be enough corpses in Brooklyn to fill Grand Army Plaza, and many of them will be women and children. Convince him."
I'll try.
Eddie stood up, then backed up, curled in the puddles of gasoline and the strews of broken glass. George Biondi was beginning to stir and mutter deep in his throat. Eddie gestured to Jack with the barrel of Roland's pistol, telling him to get up.
"You better try hard," he said.
9. Tower poured them each a cup of black coffee, then couldn't drink his. His hands were shaking too badly. After watching him try a couple of times, and thinking about a bomb disposal character in UXB who lost his nerve, Eddie took pity on him and poured half of Tower's coffee into his own cup. "Try now," he said, and pushed the half cup back to the bookshop owner. Tower had his glasses on again, but one of the bows had been twisted and they sat crookedly on his face. Also, there was the crack running across the left lens like a lightning bolt. The two men were at the marble counter, Tower behind it, Eddie perched on one of the stools. Tower had carried the book Andolini had threatened to burn first out here with him and put it down beside the coffee maker. It was as if he couldn't bear to let it out of his sight. Tower picked up the cup with his shaking hand. No rings on it, Eddie noticed, no rings on either hand, and drained it. Eddie couldn't understand why the man would choose to drink such so-so brew black. As far as Eddie himself was concerned, the really good taste was the half and half. After the months he had spent in Roland's world, or perhaps whole years had been sneaking by, it tasted as rich as heavy cream.
"Better?" Eddie asked.
"Yes." Tower looked out the window as if expecting the return of the gray town car that had jerked and swayed away just 10 minutes before. Then he looked back at Eddie. He was still frightened of the young man, but the last of his outright terror had departed when Eddie stowed the huge pistol back inside what he called my friend's swag bag. The bag was made of a scuffed, no-color leather and closed along the top with lacings rather than a zipper. To Calvin Tower, it seemed that the young man had stowed the more frightening aspects of his personality in the swag bag, along with the oversized revolver. That was good because it allowed Tower to believe that the kid had been bluffing about killing whole hoodlum families, as well as the hoodlums themselves.
"Where's your pal Deepino today?" Eddie asked.
"Oncologist. 2 years ago, Aaron started seeing blood in the toilet bowl when he moved his bowels. A younger man, he thinks goddamn hemorrhoids and buys a tube of Preparation H. Once you're in your 70s, you assume the worst. In his case, it was bad, but not terrible. Cancer moves slower when you get to be his age. Even the big C gets old. Funny to think of, isn't it? Anyway, they baked it with radiation and they say it's gone, but Aaron says you don't turn your back on cancer. He goes back every 3 months and that's where he is. I'm glad. He's an old cocker, but still a hothead.
I should introduce Aaron Deepnote to Jamie Jaffords, Eddie thought. They could play castles instead of chess and yarn away the days of the goat moon.
Tower, meanwhile, was smiling sadly. He adjusted his glasses on his face. For a moment, they stayed straight, and then they tilted again. The tilt was somehow worse than the crack, made Tower look slightly crazy, as well as vulnerable.
He's a hothead, and I'm a coward. Perhaps that's why we're friends. We fit around each other's wrong places, make something that's almost whole.
Say, maybe you're a little hard on yourself, Eddie said.
I don't think so. My analyst says that anyone who wants to know how the children of an A male father and a B female mother turn out would only have to study my case history. He also says,
cry your pardon, Calvin, but I don't give much of a shit about your analyst. You held on to the lot up the street, and that's good enough for me.
I don't take any credit for that, Calvin Tower said morosely. It's like this. He picked up the book that he'd put down beside the coffee maker. And the other ones he threatened to burn. I just have a problem letting things go. When my first wife said she wanted a divorce and I asked why, she said, because when I married you, I didn't understand. I thought you were a man. It turns out you're a pack rat.
The lot is different from the books, Eddie said.
Is it? Do you really think so? Tower was looking at him fascinated. When he raised his coffee cup, Eddie was pleased to see that the worst of his shakes had subsided.
Don't you?
Sometimes I dream about it, Tower said. I haven't actually been in there since Tommy Graham's deli went bust, and I paid to have it knocked down, and to have the fence put up, of course, which was almost as expensive as the men with the wrecking ball. I dream there's a field of flowers in there, a field of roses. And instead of just to First Avenue, it goes on forever. Funny dream, huh? Eddie was sure that Calvin Tower did indeed have such dreams, but he thought he saw something else in the eyes hiding behind the cracked and tilted glasses. He thought Tower was letting this dream stand for all the dreams he would not tell.
Funny, Eddie agreed. I think you better pour me another slug of that mud, beg you, I do. We'll have us a little palaver.
Tower smiled and once more raised the book Andolini had meant to charbroil.
Palaver. It's the kind of thing they're always saying in here.
Do you say so?
Uh-huh.
Eddie held out his hand.
Let me see.
At first Tower hesitated, and Eddie saw the bookshop owner's face briefly harden with a misery mix of emotions.
Come on, Cal, I'm not going to wipe my ass with it.
No. Of course not. I'm sorry. And at that moment, Tower looked sorry, the way an alcoholic might look after a particularly destructive bout of drunkenness. Certain books are very important to me, and this one is a true rarity. He passed it to Eddie, who looked at the plastic-protected cover and felt his heart stop.
What?
Tower asked. He set his coffee cup down with a bang. What's wrong? Eddie didn't reply. The cover illustration showed a small, rounded building like a Quonset hut, only made of wood and thatched with pine boughs. Standing off to one side was an Indian brave wearing buckskin pants. He was shirtless, holding a tomahawk to his chest. In the background, an old-fashioned steam locomotive was charging across the prairie, boiling gray smoke into a blue sky. The title of this book was The Dogon. The author was Benjamin Sleitman, Jr. From some great distance, Tower was asking him if he was going to faint. From only slightly closer by, Eddie said that he wasn't. Benjamin Sleitman, Jr. Ben Sleitman the Younger, in other words. And he pushed Tower's pudgy hand away when it tried to take the book back. Then Eddie used his own finger to count the letters in the author's name. There were, of course, 19. 10. He swallowed another cup of Towers coffee, this time without the half and half. Then he took the plastic-wrapped volume in hand once more.
"What makes it special?"
he asked.
"I mean, it's special to me because I met someone recently whose name is the same as the name of the guy who wrote this, but..."
An idea struck Eddie, and he turned to the back flap, hoping for a picture of the author. What he found instead was a curt two-line author bio. "Benjamin Sleitman, Jr. is a rancher in Montana. This is his second novel." Below this was a drawing of an eagle and a slogan, "Buy War Bonds."
"But why is it special to you? What makes it worth $7,500?
Towers' face kindled. 15 minutes before, he had been in mortal terror for his life, but you'd never know it looking at him now, Eddie thought. Now he was in the grip of his obsession. Roland had his dark tower. This man had his rare books. He held it so Eddie could see the cover.
"The Dogon, right?"
"Right."
Tower flipped the book open and pointed to the inner flap, also under plastic, where the story was summarized.
"And here?"
"The Dogon," Eddie read. "A thrilling tale of the Old West and one Indian brave's heroic effort to survive."
"So?" "Now, look at this,"
Tower said triumphantly and turned to the title page. Here, Eddie read,
"The Hogan, Benjamin Sleitman, Jr."
"I don't get it," Eddie said. "What's the big deal?"
Tower rolled his eyes. "Look again."
"Why don't you just tell me what—"
"No, look again, I insist. The joy is in the discovery, Mr. Dean. Any collector will tell you the same. Stamps, coins, or books, the joy is in the discovery." He flipped back to the cover again, and this time Eddie saw it.
"The title on the front's misprinted, isn't it? Dogon instead of Hogan."
Tower nodded happily. "A Hogan is an Indian home of the type illustrated on the front. A Dogon is, well, nothing. The misprinted cover makes the book somewhat valuable, but now, look at this." He turned to the copyright page and handed the book to Eddie. The copyright date was 1943, which of course explained the eagle and the slogan on the author bio flap. The title of the book was given as The Hogan, so that seemed all right. Eddie was about to ask when he got it for himself.
"They left the junior off the author's name, didn't they?"
"Yes, yes." Tower was almost hugging himself. "As if the book had actually been written by the author's father. In fact, once when I was at a bibliographic convention in Philadelphia, I explained this book's particular situation to an attorney who gave a lecture on copyright law, and this guy said that Sleitman Jr.'s father might actually be able to assert right of ownership over this book because of a simple typographical error. Amazing, don't you think?"
"Totally," Eddie said, thinking Sleitman the elder. Thinking Sleitman the younger.
Thinking about how Jake had become fast friends with the latter and wondering why this gave him such a bad feeling now, sitting here and drinking coffee in little old Cala, New York.
"At least he took the Ruger," Eddie thought. "Are you telling me that's all it takes to make a book valuable?" he asked Tower. "One misprint on the cover, a couple more inside, and all at once the thing's worth $7,500?
"Not at all," Tower said, looking shocked. "But Mr. Sleitman wrote 3 really excellent Western novels, all taking the Indians' point of view. The Hogan is the middle one. He became a big bug in Montana after the war, some job having to do with water and mineral rights, and then, here is the irony, a group of Indians killed him. Scalped him, actually. They were drinking outside a general store."
"A general store named Took's," Eddie thought. "I'd bet my watch and warrant on it. And apparently, Mr. Sleitman said something they took objection to, and, well, there goes your ballgame."
"Do all your really valuable books have similar stories?" Eddie asked. "I mean, some sort of coincidence makes them valuable and not just the stories themselves?"
Tower laughed. "Young man, most people who collect rare books won't even open their purchases. Opening and closing a book damages the spine, hence damaging the resale price."
"Doesn't that strike you as slightly sick behavior?"
"Not at all," Tower said, but a telltale red blush was climbing his cheeks. Part of him apparently took Eddie's point. If a customer spends $8,000 for a signed first edition of Hardy's Tess of the D'Urbervilles, it makes perfect sense to put that book away in a safe place where it can be admired but not touched. If the fellow actually wants to read the story, let him buy a vintage paperback.
You believe that? Eddie said, fascinated. You actually believe that?
Well, yes. Books can be objects of great value. That value is created in different ways. Sometimes just the author's signature is enough to do it. Sometimes, as in this case, it's a misprint. Sometimes it's a first print run, a first edition, that's extremely small. And does any of this have to do with why you came here, Mr. Dean?
Is it what you wanted to palaver about?
No, I suppose not. But what exactly had he wanted to palaver about? He'd known. It had all been perfectly clear to him as he'd herded Andolini and Biondi out of the back room, then stood in the doorway watching them stagger to the town car, supporting each other. Even in cynical, mind-your-own-business New York, they had drawn plenty of looks. Both of them had been bleeding, and both had had the same stunned what-the-hell-happened-to-me look in their eyes. Yes, then it had been clear. The book, and the name of the author, had muddied up his thinking again. He took it from Tower and set it face down on the counter so he wouldn't have to look at it. Then he went to work regathering his thoughts.
The first and most important thing, Mr. Tower, is that you have to get out of New York until July 15th. Because they'll be back. Probably not those guys specifically, but some of the other guys Balazar uses, and they'll be more eager than ever to teach you and me a lesson. Balazar's a despot.
This was a word Eddie had learned from Susanna. She had used it to describe the TikTok man.
His way of doing business is to always escalate. You slap him, he slaps back twice as hard. Punch him in the nose, he breaks your jaw. You toss a grenade, he tosses a bomb.
Tower groaned. It was a theatrical sound, although probably not meant that way, and under other circumstances Eddie might have laughed. Not under these. Besides, everything he'd wanted to say to Tower was coming back to him. He could do this dicker, by God. He would do this dicker.
Me, they probably won't be able to get at. I've got business elsewhere. Over the hills and far away, may you say so. Your job is to make sure they won't be able to get at you either.
But surely, after what you just did, and even if they didn't believe you about the women and children... Tower's eyes, wide behind his crooked spectacles, begged Eddie to say that he had really not been serious about creating enough corpses to fill Grand Army Plaza. Eddie couldn't help him there.
Cal, listen. Guys like Balazar don't believe or disbelieve. What they do is test the limits. Did I scare Big Nose? No, just knocked him out. Did I scare Jack? Yes. And it'll stick because Jack's got a little bit of imagination. Will Balazar be impressed that I scared Ugly Jack? Yes, but just enough to be cautious.
Eddie leaned over the counter, looking at Tower earnestly.
I don't want to kill kids, okay? Let's get that straight. In another place, let's leave it at that. In another place, me and my friends are going to put our lives on the line to save kids. But they're human kids. People like Jack and Trix Postino and Balazar himself, they're animals. Wolves on two legs. And do wolves raise human beings? No, they raise more wolves. Do male wolves mate with human women? No, they mate with female wolves. So if I had to go in there, and I would if I had to, I'd tell myself I was cleaning out a pack of wolves, right down to the smallest cub. No more than that, and no less.
My God, he means it, Tower said. He spoke low, and all in a breath, and to the thin air.
I absolutely do. But it's neither here nor there, Eddie said. The point is, they'll come after you, not to kill you, but to turn you around in their direction again. If you stay here, Cal, I think you can look forward to a serious maiming at the very least. Is there a place you can go until the 15th of next month? Do you have enough money? I don't have any, but I guess I could get some.
In his mind, Eddie was already in Brooklyn. Balazar, guardian angel to poker game in the back room of Bernie's barbershop, everybody knew that. The game might not be going on during a weekday, but there'd be somebody back there with cash, enough to Aaron has some money, Tower was saying reluctantly. He's offered a good many times. I've always told him no. He's also always telling me I need to go on a vacation. I think by this he means I should get away from the fellows you just turned out. He is curious about what they want, but he doesn't ask. A hothead, but a gentleman hothead. Tower smiled briefly. Perhaps Aaron and I could go on a vacation together, young sir. After all, we might not get another chance. Eddie was pretty sure the chemo and radiation treatments were going to keep Aaron Deepnow up and on his feet for at least another 4 years. But this was probably not the time to say so. He looked toward the door of the Manhattan restaurant of the mind and saw the other door. Beyond it was the mouth of the cave. Sitting there like a comic strip yogi, just a cross-legged silhouette, was the gunslinger. Eddie wondered how long he'd been gone over there, how long Roland had been listening to the muffled but still maddening sound of the Toad Ash chimes. "Would Atlantic City be far enough, do you think?" Tower asked timidly. Eddie Dean almost shuddered at the thought. He had a brief vision of two plump sheep, getting on in years, yes, but still quite tasty, wandering into not just a pack of wolves, but a whole city of them. "Not there," Eddie said. "Any place but there. What about Maine or New Hampshire? Perhaps we could rent a cottage on a lake somewhere until the 15th of July?" Eddie nodded. He was a city boy. It was hard for him to imagine the bad guys way up in northern New England wearing those checkered caps and down vests as they chomped their pepper sandwiches and drank their Rufino. "That'd be better," he said. "And while you're there, you might see if you could find a lawyer." Tower burst out laughing. Eddie looked at him, head cocked, smiling a little himself. It was always good to make folks laugh, but it was better when you knew what the fuck they were laughing at. "I'm sorry," Tower said after a moment or two. "It's just that Aaron was a lawyer. His sister and two brothers, all younger, are still lawyers. They like to boast that they have the most unique legal letterhead in New York, perhaps in the entire United States. It reads simply, Deepnow." "That speeds things up," Eddie said. "I want you to have Mr. Deepnow draw up a contract while you're vacationing in New England." "Hiding in New England," Tower said. He suddenly looked morose. "Hold up in New England." "Call it what you wanna," Eddie said. "But get that paper drawn up. You're going to sell that lot to me and my friends, to the Tet Corporation. You're just going to get a buck to start with, but I can almost guarantee you that in the end you'll get fair market value." He had more to say, lots, but stopped there. When he'd held his hand out for the book, the Dogan or the Hogan or whatever it was, an expression of miserly reluctance had come over Tower's face. What made the look unpleasant was the undercurrent of stupidity in it, and not very far under either. Oh, God, he's going to fight me on this. After everything that's happened, he's still going to fight me on it. And why? Because he really is a pack rat. "You can trust me, Cal," he said, knowing trust was not exactly the issue. "I set my watch and warrant on it. Hear me now. Hear me, I beg." "I don't know you from Adam. You walk in off the street and save your life. Don't forget that part." Tower's face grew set and stubborn. "They weren't going to kill me. You said that yourself." "They were gonna burn your favorite books, your most valuable ones." "Not my most valuable. Also, that might have been a bluff." Eddie took a deep breath and let it out, hoping his suddenly strong desire to lean across the counter and sink his fingers into Tower's fat throat would depart, or at least subside. He reminded himself that if Tower hadn't been stubborn, he probably would have sold the lot to Sombra long before now. The rose would have been plowed under. And the Dark Tower? Eddie had an idea that when the rose died, the Dark Tower would simply fall like the one in Babel when God had gotten tired of it and wiggled his finger. No waiting around another 100,000 years for the machinery running the beams to quit. Just ashes, ashes, we all fall down. And then, hail the Crimson King, Lord of Toad Ash Darkness. "Cal, if you sell me and my friends your vacant lot, you're off the hook. Not only that, but you'll eventually have enough money to run your little shop for the rest of your life." He had a sudden thought. "Hey, do you know a company called Holmes Dental?" Tower smiled. Who doesn't? I use their floss. And their toothpaste. I tried the mouthwash, but it's too strong. Why do you ask?
Because Odetta Holmes is my wife. I may look like Froggy the Gremlin, but in truth, I'm Prince fucking Charming.
Tower was quiet for a long time. Eddie curbed his impatience and let the man think. At last, Tower said, You think I'm being foolish? That I'm being Silas Marner, or worse, Ebenezer Scrooge?
Eddie didn't know who Silas Marner was, but he took Tower's point from the context of the discussion.
Let's put it this way, he said. After what you've just been through, you're too smart not to know where your best interests lie.
I feel obligated to tell you that this isn't just mindless miserliness on my part. There's an element of caution as well. I know that piece of New York is valuable. Any piece of Manhattan is, but it's not just that. I have a safe out back. There's something in it, something perhaps even more valuable than my copy of Ulysses.
Then why isn't it in your safe deposit box?
Because it's supposed to be here, Tower said. It's always been here. Perhaps waiting for you or someone like you. Once, Mr. Dean, my family owned almost all of Turtle Bay, and, well, wait. Will you wait?
Yes, Eddie said. What choice?
11. When Tower was gone, Eddie got off the stool and went to the door only he could see. He looked through it. Dimly, he could hear chimes. More clearly, he could hear his mother.
Why don't you get out of there? She called dolorously. You'll only make things worse, Eddie. You always do. That's my ma, he thought, and called the gunslinger's name.
Roland pulled one of the bullets from his ear. Eddie noted the oddly clumsy way he handled it, almost pawing at it, as if his fingers were stiff, but there was no time to think about it now.
Are you all right? Eddie called.
Do fine, and you?
Yeah, but, Roland, can you come through? I might need a little help.
Roland considered, then shook his head. The box might close if I did. Probably would close. Then the door would close and we'd be trapped on that side.
Can't you prop the damn thing open with a stone or a bone or something?
No, Roland said. It wouldn't work. The ball is powerful.
And it's working on you, Eddie thought.
Roland's face looked haggard, the way it had when the Lobstrosity's poison had been inside him.
All right, he said.
Be as quick as you can.
I will.
12. When he turned around, Tower was looking at him quizzically.
Who were you talking to?
Eddie stood aside and pointed at the doorway.
Do you see anything there, Si?
Calvin Tower looked, started to shake his head, then looked longer.
A shimmer, he said at last, like hot air over an incinerator. Who's there? What's there?
For the time being, let's say nobody. What have you got in your hand?
Tower held it up. It was an envelope, very old. Written on it in copperplate were the words Stefan Torin and dead letter. Below, carefully drawn in ancient ink, were the same symbols that were on the door and the box. Unfound.
Now we might be getting somewhere, Eddie thought.
Once this envelope held the will of my great-great-great-grandfather, Calvin Tower said. It was dated March 19, 1846. Now, there's nothing but a single piece of paper with a name written upon it. If you can tell me what that name is, young man, I'll do as you ask. And so, Eddie mused, it comes down to another riddle. Only this time it wasn't four lives that hung upon the answer, but all of existence.
Thank God it's an easy one, he thought. It's Deschaine, Eddie said. The first name will be either Roland, the name of my din, or Stephen, the name of his father.
All the blood seemed to fall out of Calvin Tower's face. Eddie had no idea how the man was able to keep his feet.
My dear God in heaven, he said.
With trembling fingers, he removed an ancient and brittle piece of paper from the envelope, a time traveler that had voyaged over 131 years to this where and when. It was folded. Tower opened it and put it on the counter where they could both read the words Stefan Torin had written in the same firm copperplate hand. Roland Deschaine of Gilead, the line of Eld,
Gunslinger. 13. There was more talk, about 15 minutes worth, and Eddie supposed at least some of it was important. But the real deal had gone down when he'd told Tower the name his 3 times great-grandfather had written on a slip of paper 14 years ago.